The Money Cafe is brought to you by Eureka Report, your one-stop shop for all things finance. To sign up for your free 15-day trial, head to eurekareport.com.au. Now it's time to enjoy today's episode.
Hello, I'm Alan Kohler, founder of Eureka Report, finance presenter on the ABC News and columnist for The New Daily.
And I'm Stephen Mayne, contributor at Eureka, founder of Crikey, shareholder advocate and City of Manningham councillor.
And we are...
we are The Money Cafe.
But not in the cafe. We're remote this time because you are somewhere else, Stephen.
Yes, I'm on a family road trip on the New South Wales south coast. I've managed to look at a few dodgy pokies venues while I've been here, Alan. The Batemans Bay Soldiers Club last night, a very ordinary venue. But apart from that, I'm trying to have a holiday with the family and my two sisters.
Do you graffiti the pokies venues
no,
while you're there?
No, I just go in, take a few photos.
Give them a bit of a daub of paint.
Yes, do a few tweets the next morning when I've safely left the premises and then get back to the family. But, they're having a big – the Club Managers Association are having their big annual conference at the Batemans Bay Soldiers Club. So I figured if it's the venue for all the club CEOs to get together that it must be quite special. And, a real Taj Mahal with a very sophisticated marketing regime. And they've made a couple hundred million from pokies gamblers in the last 12 years. So they are a very successful private casino club masquerading as an RSL.
So I want to start with Aesop this week because it's been sold to L'Oreal for $3.7 billion. And just to reflect on what a fantastic story it is and what a great Australian brand and success story it really is. Aesop started by Dennis Perfidis in 1987. He was a hairdresser. He decided to sell some products, some beauty products on the side. But the real genius, I reckon, in the story is Michael O'Keefe, who's been CEO for 20 years, and he is the one who really invented the shops that the branding and the whole kind of idea. Well, it was him and Dennis, I guess, but, Michael really has been the one who took it to the world and really created the value in Aesop. And they've got, I think they've got stores all over the world now, haven't they, Stephen?
They do. I think it is an incredible success story. Fast-moving consumer goods is not something that Australians are usually very good at. Over the years, we've produced quite a few global CEOs of foreign-owned fast-moving consumer goods like Coke and Kellogg's and the likes. But this is a rare example of a startup in Australia, stores all over the world, and now sold to L'Oreal, which is, a conglomerate valued at US $225 billion, and they've paid $3.7 billion for Aesop. So well done to Michael and Dennis. And the Brazilians, it's just an interesting way to go about it. But, I hope they're both on the rich list, Mr. Perfidis and Mr. O'Keefe, because they thoroughly deserve it, having created so much value.
Yeah, when you mentioned Brazilians, it's probably worth mentioning that they sold to, Dennis Perfidis brought in private equity in 2010. They bought a minority stake in it. And then in 2012, he sold 65% to the Brazilian-owned Natura Cosméticos about $100 million Australian for 65%. And then the rest of 4 years later to Natura. So
well done to the Brazilians. They don't have too many global success stories. But they've fixed up the Australians with this one, buying an Australian invention, then flipping it a few years later and making what's probably a 10 or 20 bagger for them. But great
Natura
story.
It should be noted, Natura is not a private equity firm that flips things, but they are. For them, Aesop was a good buy. I mean, it was an extension of their business, and they should have held it. But they're in trouble. They're actually selling it because they have to. So.
Yes, but when you have to sell something and someone gives you $3.7 billion for it and you paid a fraction of that for it, you're still patting yourself on the back. So, I mean, how many other great Australian success stories have there been where the branded stores are all over the world? Like you've got Flight Centre, you've got Domino's, I'd even say Solly Lou's Smiggle is a good example. Billabong back in the day, although it ended up being a disaster, Quicksilver, maybe Cotton On. But, yeah, it's not something you normally associate with Australian startups. Normally we're just big mining companies. So so well done to all involved.
And another one is Guzmán y Gómez, which is this, I think this week or last week, got a valuation of $1.6 billion in raising some money. So, you know, I'm a big fan of Guzmán y Gómez. I have it all the time. It's great. And good luck to them. And they've got stores around the world as well.
They do. They do. I mean, it's pretty ambitious for an Australian company to roll out a global Mexican food chain, sort of Hungry Jack's style. So it's different from the McDonald's model and the Domino's model in that they're company-owned stores. They're not franchises. And it's had its share of controversies. You know, Magellan was in there, bought 11%, got criticised for it, sold down, made a bit of a profit. This valuation that's just been achieved is an interesting one because it goes to sort of that Hearts and Minds charity fund, which is bought in at that valuation, which sort of affirms the valuation of what a number of other fund managers have paid for this business. Because sometimes when you've got an unlisted business, you just need someone to sell a few shares at a certain price and everyone says, aha, that's the price. So, as you've pointed out, there's a valuation of $1.6 billion paid by someone at the moment, and so everyone else is saying, that's it, that's the valuation, aren't we doing well? And I do hope they continue to succeed because, again, it's not the traditional Aussie-style, you know, success story. You've had a few like Grilled, which sort of started up locally, or the Burger Joint, which was a good locally developed success story. But they are good burgers. To try and roll that out globally at the food level, I mean, only really Domino's has managed to do that in the past. So I hope they pull it off.
Yeah, well, Guzmán y Gómez started by Stephen Marks, who is actually American, who came here and thought the quality of the Mexican food in Australia was no good, so he thought he'd do something about it. And good luck.
A bit like Hungry Jack Cowan, who came here from Canada in must have been the late 60s, early 70s, and decided. And he's the king of fast food. He owns Hungry Jack's. Sued the American franchise parent at one point, got a $70 million settlement, and now he owns 25% of Domino's as well, in which he's made over $1 billion on that as well. So you're right. You get these Americans who come to Australia and say, the food's crap, let's roll something out, and they make a great success of it.
Yeah, but his burgers are no good, in my opinion.
I agree.
I think they microwave them. They're appalling.
Yes. Yes, and I never forgave Hungry. I mean, I like Hungry Jack. I used to chat to him at a few AGMs, but he sat there on the Channel 10 board for must have been 15 years and never put any of his fortune seriously into the stock. And I think he was there with Fairfax. When a Rich Lister buys into a trophy media company, and I say this for the late Ron Walker as well, the former chairman of Fairfax, who was supposedly, according to his own BRW Rich List, worth $800 million, yet he barely ever put $800,000 into his Fairfax shares. So Rich Listers on public company boards, stump up and write a big check if you want to hold those positions is the lesson of the day.
You would, wouldn't you, Stephen?
If I had that set of dollars, absolutely I'd be writing a check to get some alignment. Skin in the game, alignment is absolutely right. And you don't want to see a Rich Lister sitting on a board with, you know, with barely a few bob committed to the stock he's stewarding, he or she.
Speaking of Rich Listers, you want to talk about Musk's interview with BBC this morning. I didn't listen to it or read it, so what went on?
Yes, look, a rare interview with Elon where he told the BBC journalist that it was a lot of pain that he had suffered from buying Twitter. He'd been surprised by the amount of abuse that he's copped, that it may be cash positive this quarter, but, you know, it's still a bit of a struggle. He's treated his staff fairly. Everyone got at least a three-month severance, and that would he sell it to someone for $44 billion? Initially he said, which is what he paid, initially he said no, and then he said, well, it depends who. So he's obviously very conscious of the power of Twitter.
But no one's going to pay $44 billion. It's not worth half that, is it?
That's right. But he's basically saying he'd be a very reluctant seller at $44 billion. In other words, it's a trophy asset. He enjoys the power. He is not ready to give up the power, but he's regretting the pain, not enjoying sleeping in the office. It's taken over his life, forced him to sell down some Twitter shares. And, you know, I think, frankly, the biggest mistake he's made is that he's damaged his own reputation and he's damaged Tesla's reputation. And a lot of people aren't buying Teslas now because of the way he's carried on at Twitter. And so it just has made absolutely no sense whatsoever to go from being the richest bloke in the world and a much admired entrepreneur to being a sort of a love-hate figure who a large proportion of the slightly progressive voting left now don't particularly fancy because of the way he's carried on as the Twitter proprietor. And even this morning he was trying to bag the BBC journal about so-called COVID misinformation that the BBC had been putting out. I mean, you know, just leave it alone, Elon, all this rubbish you're going with.
Speaking of, I mean, another overpriced acquisition was Wesfarmers buying Coles, whenever that was, before the GFC.
2007. Well, 2007? We all said it was overpriced.
They paid too much, definitely.
Well, it was $20 billion in cash at the time, and look, Wesfarmers shares got down to sort of $15, and they had to do all these emergency capital raisings after the GFC. But look, they've sold their final 2.8% this week for $688 million at $18.50 a Coles share. Now, that values the whole of Coles at $24.5 billion. But they've still got to keep a lot of the other parts of Coles, which they bought, which was in Officeworks, Kmart, and Target. So I'm now going to say, with Wesfarmers shares at $52, that overall I think they got good value from what they paid for Coles in terms of how it has turned out in the end. And these things can change. They did overpay at the start because they could have bought Coles after the GFC for probably $12 billion. But net, 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 you look at all the outcomes in the last 15 years, the purchase of Coles, I think, has added value to Wesfarmers, and it's not like some of those notorious worst ever takeovers such as AMP buying the National Mutual Australian business, or the worst of all, Slater and Gordon, the law firm, paying $1.3 billion cash for a UK business called Quindell, which was basically worthless and immediately sent Slater and Gordon broke within 12 months.
I remember that was a ripper, that was.
Oh, that was as bad as they come. Cash, $1.3 billion cash for a pile of steaming excrement. Anyway, now last thing I want to do before questions, Alan, is the Oz Minerals scheme meeting was held this morning. And so speaking of takeovers, it is farewell to Oz Minerals because 98% of the voted stock supported the deal, although the turnout was only 57% of all shares on issue. And with takeovers with a scheme of arrangement, you've got to get the two metrics. So you've got to get this more than 75% of voted stock, and you've got to get more than 50% of the shareholders who turn out. So that is a metric which empowers the small shareholder. Unfortunately, I've just never ever seen anyone do the equivalent of a branch stacking exercise to vote down a takeover. It's just never happened. We got close with MIM, where they only got 53% when Xstrata bought them in 2003, but they got 79% of the small shareholders voting in favour this morning. But that was 2,728 in favour and 383 patriotic souls who voted against selling out to Oz Minerals. But the turnout was only 7%. So only 3,111 of the 44,000 shareholders bothered to vote. So it is the great problem with retail shareholders, whether it's capital raisings or votings. The vast majority just don't bother to do it. They don't participate. They are inert, asleep shareholders. So 93% of Oz Minerals shareholders, their company has just been sold today and they have not turned up to vote, which is about the inverse of political elections where only 7% don't vote and 93% do on average. So we've got a real problem with shareholder voting turnouts in public companies.
Well, it's the inverse of you too, Stephen. You do show up, do you not?
Well, I failed to dial into the Adelaide airport for the vote this morning because I'm supposedly on holidays. But I did want to say briefly about the Santos AGM last week because we spoke about that last week, how they were saying how they were having a physical AGM with no online participation. Well, I ended up watching the webcast and it was a disgrace. They actually had a question registration desk outside the hall So you had to actually leave the meeting and put your name down to ask a question, and then they'd read out your name, and then they'd only let you ask one question, and then they'd turn the microphone off after you read it. So the chairman, Ken Spence, at the end of the meeting said, oh, this was a great meeting, so much better than last year, because it was only 2 hours, about 50 minutes was them banging on. And quite a few female Indigenous speakers basically got barely heard. And then on watching the webcast, you'd hear the sort of people sort of shouting, but you couldn't work it out because they'd turned the microphones off. And so all these traditional owners from the Pilago up near Narrabri and from the Tiwi Islands who were opposing the Barossa field, really their voices weren't particularly well heard because of the way that Santos structured the meeting, even though these people had travelled all the way from interstate to attend the physical only AGM because they banned online questions because I asked them a dozen online last year. So not happy with Santos and the way they suppress the voices and the votes of shareholders to try and control the narrative at their AGM.
Maybe it should be run by the Electoral Commission.
Absolutely, Alan. I mean, if it's good enough for unions, I've often said this, particularly with schemes of arrangements, like you can't even have an audit of a vote, and you can't even appoint scrutineers, independent scrutineers. So, I mean, it was back in the day when Xstrata bought MIM with the two Ks, Kerr Nielsen and Paul Keating, running a vociferous campaign against it, and it only got over the line with 53% of the shareholders in favour and a narrow majority on the 75%. But there was no ability back then to do an independent audit. So there was a real problem with corporate voting, and I'll second your motion to hand the whole thing over to the Electoral Commission going forward.
It's the last thing they want to do, but anyway.
Yes. Now, what about Bitcoin, Alan? You reckon it's a risk-on exercise at the moment and prices are getting out of hand?
Well, let's note that it is at $30,000 now, up 80% this year. But the thing, what interests me is that the price of Bitcoin actually took off on March the 10th, which was when Silicon Valley Bank went broke. And so clearly it took off and went from, 30,000 Australian to 40,000 Australian quick smart in a week or so, and then it stayed there for a while. But look, I think it's really interesting that a lot of people worried about the banking system decided to buy bitcoins instead of having their money in the bank. Obviously, that's what happened, and they pushed the price up, and it's had another kick lately. So, I mean, it's part of, as you say, it's part of a risk-on atmosphere in the markets. Generally, the stock market has gone up, 10 times in the past 11 sessions in Australia. Mm. It's unbelievable.
Mm.
So the market, investors have decided that everything's fine. Don't worry. No recession. It'll be fine.
I don't get it. I think there's going to be a recession, and I think these prices, they're overcooked. So if I held Bitcoin, which I don't, I'd be selling at anything above 30,000 US. But then again, it did get to 64,000, so it's still got a fair way to go, but it has risen, you're right, 85% since the bank collapse. So, crypto, Alan, I've never been a fan. But if only there was just one, if we could just read this one crypto and that's it, just Bitcoin, and then know what all these other copycat come out and try and – that's where it gets wild, Doge and all that other rubbish. So just leave it at Bitcoin. And then, we can have an alternative, and it can be an alternative to gold, which is a haven when you're worried about too much money printing or central banks going crazy with policy. It's a private sector response to that, and clearly it's got a lot of credibility given it's recovered after all that's happened. The fact that Bitcoin's back above 30,000 with all these crypto wipeouts does show that I think it's got some staying power.
Well, yes, right. And usually in the past it goes up a lot. It usually has a run ahead of a halving. I think it's every 4 years that the amount of Bitcoins you get for solving the problems that are involved in Bitcoin mining halves. And the next halving is next year in 2024. So it's a bit early for that. So it's going up independently of the halving this time, which is unusual.
Yes. Yes. Well,
you'd know all about the halving and stuff, wouldn't you? The exahashes and how you go about Bitcoin mining, wouldn't you?
It's all Greek to me, yeah, Alan. It's all Greek. I'm an old-fashioned bloke, 53-year-old, you know, still dealing with ComSec, still buying top 300 stocks. So that world has passed me by. I'm sorry. I know you're a convert, though. You're always up with the latest.
No, I think it's very interesting. I'm not a convert. I mean, I don't buy Bitcoins. I don't own any. I think it's very interesting, though.
Yeah. I'm now going to say it's here for good and it's not just a fly-by-night scheme. But a lot of the copycat ones, and there's a lot of crooks and crims in the money clipping Sam Bankman-Fried down. But the actual Bitcoin concept, a limited number, a store of value, clearly, you know, it's worth tens of billions and it's going for a run. And those that were on it, well done.
Yeah, well, it's 15 years old and worth $30,000 a pop. So, you know, clearly it's not going away.
Correct. Correct. Shall we do some questions?
Yes.
You can start.
Okay. Bill says, the commentary on the emerging new super tax seems to be continuing with the unveiling of the tax being placed on earnings and not the familiar taxable income. The new tax is to be on the change in total superannuation balances, TSB, over a financial year. So we are facing a new tax based on the changes to TSB, based on income and a revaluation of assets held, ignoring pension or lump sum payments. Aside from the issue many people have raised about the cash flow difficulties this will impose on superannuants, I wonder just how the progressive creation of annual tax liabilities derived from the unrealized gains on assets will be balanced and accounted for when the actual capital gain or loss is eventually realized. Well, I wonder that too, Bill. And I mean, obviously, I don't believe they'll go ahead with charging tax on unrealized gains. It's a totally new principle in taxation. I don't think they'll go ahead with it. I mean, surely not. But there's been no announcement, no sign yet that they've dropped that. And in fact, the bill, I mean, I haven't been keeping a close eye on this, and Bill seems to be suggesting that they have, they're sort of doubling down on it.
Yeah, well, it sounds like they are going to persist with it. I agree that I think it's barking mad and it's too hard. But you have to admit that within the superannuation system, you know, where there are lots of, you know, whoever owns Sydney Airport now, they are unlisted assets that have to be privately valued. And when people come in and go out of those super funds, those unlisted lumpy assets have to be valued to come up with people's entry and exit point on a unit pricing sort of model. So, look, I accept that there has to be an element of valuation and taxation of unlisted assets at the wholesale institutional level, but I just have grave doubts about putting this down to the individual punter with this tax grab that we've got now. And because you don't do it in housing investments, negatively geared properties, et cetera. So, you know, I just wish...
Well, I was going to say, I mean, if they put this in place on superannuation tax, how can they not do it for investment property? And
then how can they not do it for ordinary shares? I mean, the principle of you pay a tax when you realise an asset is for the retail investor is absolutely everywhere in property and shares. It's only when you enter into the land of the superannuation structure that it suddenly the rules are different. So I just think they're fundamentally different rules, and we need to be consistent. But I guess it's just offsetting the fact that it's such a tax-preferred environment to be in. It's just the government trying to make it less tax-preferred, but they're just making it more complex and messy by coming up with this model. And I think it's going to cause a lot of heartache. Now, Philip says, Alan, the government does not want to let people use their super to invest in their own home, yet it wants big super to invest in homes for other people.
Now, don't read ChatGPT's whole. I mean, he's asked ChatGPT and he's ChatGPT, and you know he's got this whole epic long answer.
Yeah, so ChatGPT has just come back and pointed out that Sydney property has returned 8.4% over the last 20 years, yet Australian Super has returned 7.6% over the last 20 years, and so he's sort of basically going on to say, well, you know, which is better, and I think he's making a good point there that Sydney property and long-term industry funds have probably been comparable, but it's also a bit of a apples and oranges scenario because the Australian Super return of 7.6%, that's a total shareholder return equivalent. So that's earnings and capital growth, whereas the metric you're looking at with Sydney Property, it's just the actual capital growth each year over 20 years, not looking at the holding cost if you're living in it, improvements, operating costs, paying the rates, et cetera, et cetera. So,
but it's also, I mean, it's also geared. So it's generally 20% equity and 80% debt. And so that 8.4% on the equity turns into quite large.
It's the whole private equity model shows that you supercharge returns when you gear something up. And that's partly why so many super funds have got such a large allocation to private equity now, because they deliver the best returns because they supercharge, and the super funds themselves can't borrow. But, of course, they can allocate to private equity managers who gear themselves to the eyeball and generally over the long term have delivered excellent returns, which is why they're getting such a big share of the mandates these days.
One is from Michael, who loves the podcast. My superannuation provider won't let me open an account unless I have a financial advisor. Is this right? I'm a long-standing client, greater than 10 years of AMP / North, and I have a retirement pension account. I asked them to open a superannuation account so I could work on the recent New South Wales state election, and they refused, as I don't have a financial advisor. I think that's crazy. Why should I need a financial advisor when having a super account is actually a condition of employment? Yes, I agree.
Well, I agree with Michael too, but at the end of the day, if you're tied up with AMP, which is the largest employer of financial advisors in the country, then I'm not surprised that they're pushing their business model, which is we'll only let you run a super fund if you have an advisor, because we are the most still, even after losing billions and having reputational blow-ups in Royal Commissions and the like, we are still the number one employer of financial advisors in the country, because they've got, I think it's a 20% market share. They're the number one retail super fund in the country. But I agree that AMP should allow you not to have an advisor. But I think, Michael, you should have just gone with Aware Super, which is the old New South Wales state super scheme. They're probably the default fund for the New South Wales Electoral Commission. So you should have just said, if you want me to work a few booths on polling day, please just open up a super account with your standard fund where you can pay the money into it rather than getting it all too complicated by forcing AMP into the non-advisor world. But I agree, it's annoying to have to open a new fund when you just want to do a little bit of spot extra work, such as working on an election campaign.
I reckon AMP should be all over, Michael, with gifts and dinners for being a 10-year client. Crikey. I mean,
what the hell were you thinking, Michael, staying with the bank?
I know. This is very, very loyal of you, Michael, to have stuck with them for so long. Because yes. I think that I'm not sure.
They have underperformed. They never broke the power of the agents. At the end of the day, the story of AMP was the agents had too much power. They always ran their business on a high fee, conflicted sort of agent model, and then they underperformed as well. And they had a very high cost base. And I mean, I'll never forget that AMP used to own 10% of Macquarie. I think at one point they even owned as much as 15% of Westpac. If they just sat back and held onto those two stakes alone, they would have outperformed. But look, they were just very bad stock pickers over a long period of time, and hence their AGM was a 3-hour slam fest a couple of weeks ago. With they've still got 450,000 angry small shareholders who remember a stock at 15 now at 1. Anyway,
Mark's got a question about the rental crisis, which he says is horrendous. It's a long question, and he's got tables and circles and arrows on the back, but we'll cut it down. He says the Gold Coast Mayor Tom Tate is onto the right idea when he suggests people renting out spare rooms in their house. The first and quickest step to solving the crisis would be to release or use the housing assets that already exist. I would advocate an extension of the CGT exemption for principal places of residence to allow the renting of portions of the property. Something of this nature already exists with granny flats. Well, that's an interesting idea, don't you think?
Look, I agree. That is the reality at the moment. It's so expensive to construct at the moment with all these builders going broke and with record levels of immigration, there's a rental crisis. And so the logical response is to get higher utilization of your existing built assets. And if changing the tax system so someone who rents out a room in their principal primary residence is not going to suddenly get dragged into the capital gains tax net because they've been turning their home into a partial investment property, then change the tax laws to make it give people more of an incentive to max out their rooms. Because I like the idea of people being in share houses. You know, like students need to learn how to work together, manners, you know, getting off the screen, getting out of their bedrooms, homes, and actually, you know, living a real life.
Sharing joints.
With other people, sharing
joints.
Yes, Alan. I never did that. But, yeah.
You didn't? I mean, why not? What's the matter with you?
This is a business podcast, Alan. We're not talking about our drug-taking activities 30 years ago.
No, but, carry on.
Yeah, so I like that idea. But, I mean, right at the moment, I'll give you a little Manningham anecdote. We want to build a new library at the Pines in East Doncaster. But, you know, God, it's going to cost us, who knows, 40, 50 million. So I've been saying, look, it's cheaper if we just buy the nearby Pokies joint, the Cherry Hill Tavern, which is leased to Endeavour Group but owned by Charter Hall and the Host Plus Superfund. It's only on the books at like 18 million. So we should buy that and turn that into a library. We can probably do it for 25 million without having to build our own standalone library for 40 or 50 million. So the idea of repurposing existing assets or getting better utilization out of existing assets is the way we need to go with this crazy cost of construction environment. And if you've got a spare room, people, lease it out. You can get record rentals at the moment, and you can accommodate some international students and some key workers, and hopefully not get hit with too much tax on the way through.
Next.
All right. Michael says, great show, Alan and Stephen. 10 years ago, I would see lots of marketing regarding courses for day trading, contracts for difference, CFDs, futures, options, share trading, etc. These all seem to have disappeared. Did the promoters of these go broke or become wealthy enough and no longer need to promote these products? What do you reckon, Alan? I think it's probably...
I would say if there's demand, he's right, but if there was a demand for these things, they would definitely exist. So I don't think anyone's gone broke. I just think that everyone either knows now or thinks they know and don't want to learn anymore.
I reckon people have gone off to crypto. I think that the loss of the Securities Institute many years ago, it was sold off to some Washington education provider or something. So they were a great provider of courses. They were not for profit. So them disappearing wasn't good. I think ASIC might have come in and been a bit tougher on the licensing regime with some of these course providers. And I know a lot of people got burnt badly on contracts for difference. And I also suspect that it just wasn't viable for people to make a living as a day trader on futures, options or share trading. And many of the people who thought they could do that have gone off and they're into crypto now. So you just haven't got as many people aspiring to learn these courses, probably regulator intervention, not a very good market, and particularly contracts for difference. They were toxic. They were almost worse than poker machines in terms of being a dangerous high-risk product like a casino, and a lot of people lost a lot of money. And the promoters of them, like IG Markets and the rest, have all done very nicely. Thanks very much.
Yep. Anonymous says, I enjoyed your recent clip on the ABC about migration trends. It got a fair bit of reaction on Reddit. So I don't look at Reddit, so didn't see that. Do you think this pressure may finally result in Australians becoming predominantly apartment dwellers, increasing public transport usage and home energy efficiency? I work full-time and live in a 3-bedroom, 5-adult share house, which is probably the way everyone will be living fairly soon without better housing developments. Yes, well, we've just been talking about that, and we're very much in favour of share houses. So 5 adults and 3 bedrooms.
I'm sharing a holiday house this week with I think 12 people in 3 bedrooms. So we're really going cheek by jowl with lots of late teens and early 20s university students and the like. But no, it's been a lot of fun. I think more people should learn how to do this.
You'll be looking forward to getting back to your Manningham mansion, though, won't you, Steve?
Yes, that's right. You'll like this. I had to send them off to the local cafe so I could quietly record the Money Cafe with you.
So there's 12 of them infesting the local cafe
because I've cleared the house for a studio quality master bedroom laptop effort with you. But look, I agree that we've got to get construction going on housing. Councils have got to issue more permits. We need more public investment in housing. There's a whole bunch of things that need to be done here, but maybe they need to dial back the migration tap just a fraction. They went full throttle too quickly, and I think it's really starting to creak, and maybe they just need to dial that back a fraction. But the universities were thirsting for it after losing so many billions during COVID. And a lot of employers were calling for it, and the government has really opened the floodgates. Michael of Ringwood says, with CPI, do they always compare year to year? Inflation seems to be at 6-7% each month. Prices are not rising at 6% each month. By my reckoning, if inflation prices jump from 2% to 7% from, say, May to June, then if we compare year to year, we'll stay at 6-7% next June unless prices plummet, which is unlikely. Have I got it wrong? And finally, PS, which cafe do you do the podcasts in? Now, I can do the last bit, La Clec in Glenferrie Road, Hawthorne, but you're the expert on inflation, Alan. How does it all work, monthly versus quarterly versus annual?
I completely agree with Michael of Ringwood because it's true that they always publish annual figures. So they've got a monthly CPI and a quarterly CPI. The monthly one is kind of less, I don't know, it seems to be less kind of detailed in some way, but they, but even with the monthly one, they say the inflation, they publish the inflation over the past 12 months. And I think the more relevant thing is month by month. And then you can get a sense of how it's going, because you can still see an inflation rate of 6-7%, as Michael says, published in a particular month, but actually, in the recent months, in the last few months, it's been coming. The inflation rate's been coming down, and that's what's been going on. In fact, so just when they use the annual figure, it just means that it takes much more time to have an impact on the figure. It just kind of
The headline figure doesn't jerk around as much because you've still got the baggage of the previous 11 months. So one incremental month change can only move it so much.
So I agree with you.
It should be. I'd actually prefer we go back to this quarter inflation was 1%, and because quarterly is long enough, a month is too short. It's like you don't get companies doing monthly reports, do you?
Well, they still publish both. So they've got the quarterly CPI, which is the main one. And they do publish the figure for the quarter and the year, but with the monthly one, they don't publish the one for the monthly. So, for the ABC News, what I have to do is go in and download the Excel spreadsheet, and then calculate the percentage change over the past month, because they don't actually say it in the release. They don't say it even. So I've got to download the darn thing and calculate it.
Well, we're lucky we've got you, Alan, to make sense of it, but surely a man of your heft would be able to send a quiet letter on ABC letterhead to the statisticians and just request that they add that little extra bit of granularity in their quarterly figure to make it easier for you to be the educator of the nation on all matters finance at 7:15 each weeknight.
Well, in fact, I think I've got David Gruen, the statistician, head statistician on speed dial, so I'll just give him a call. What do you say?
That's right. I can't believe you haven't sorted this out, that you're having to use megaphone diplomacy through the Money Cafe to get better data. If you were like Anthony Green, you'd have already got all the data coming to you perfectly, bespokely created for your needs. As he has done with every electoral commission in the country.
Yeah, but the thing is that if the ABS publishes the monthly data, then everyone will have it. Whereas at the moment, I've got it to myself because I do it.
Because you work it out yourself.
So it's a little scoop.
Yes. I find there's a lot of companies like Macquarie, when you ask them for data, they say, I'm sorry, we're not going to give that to you. And I just then say, well, I'm not going to be Kohler-esque in my scoop obsession. Can you just tell the ASX itself, tell the world next time how many shareholders voted for and against and how many shareholders participated in the capital raising or whatever the data request is? But you're right. Companies are reluctant to give you something privately because they're so stuck in with that equal disclosure for all mentality. So just disclose the lot to everyone and less scoops for Kohler, I say.
Whose side do you want, Stephen?
Journalists are too obsessed with scoops, beating people and not giving credit to other people with their scoops. Just cover the stuff that matters and don't worry about who covers it first. That's what I say. Well, it's called post-journalism. Anyway, we're done.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to today's scoops on the Money Cafe. I'll be back next week with Stephen Mayne again.
Because unlike James Thompson, I have to work on my holidays. There's no holiday loading, readers and listeners, I can tell you as well. Whereas James Thompson gets to go on a real holiday where he doesn't have to read up for the Money Cafe. But I'm driving all the way back to Melbourne to be with Alan next Thursday.
Excellent. Well,
you need to mention that email address now, Alan.
themoneycafe@eurekareport.com.au. Send in your questions and Stephen and I will answer them in the Leclerc Cafe, Glenfrey Road, Hawthorne next week. Till then, I'm Alan Kohler, founder of Eureka Report and a presenter of finance on the ABC News and columnist for New Daily.
And I'm Stephen Mayne, one of Alan's many contributors at Eureka Report, the founder of Crikey, shareholder, activist and a councillor at the City of Manningham. Talk to you soon.